Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Liminalist. This is The Liminalist, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the dough and dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for an oddity chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
Okay, I have to tell you that it will take you about 5 minutes to get used to my accent. Hopefully after that it will be easier.
I think I'm already used to it. I'm a world traveler, so okay. I've experienced many strange accents. Yeah, where is the accent from again? Remind me.
Siberia,
oh my God. Mm. Where shamans first emerged from.
Yes.
Right. Well, we may get to Siberia then in this conversation at some point. But I thought we should start simply with, perhaps not so simple at all, but your field of interest and research, the books that you've written. The general theme that interests me, or one of them, is how you're approaching the question of autism.
Mm-hmm.
And the relationship between behaviours, which of course is how autism is generally recognised and diagnosed, is simply through observing behaviours. The correlation between these behaviours that are observed and diagnosed and actually what's going on internally in terms of a different way of perceiving the world.
Okay, then I have to start with my background, then you will see why I'm here and why I'm doing what I'm doing. As I said, I was born in Siberia. I left quite early, I mean after school. And I was educated in Moscow in the Linguistic University. And my first PhD was in linguistics. And I never heard about autism. And for 10 years, I lived in Ukraine, the eastern part of Ukraine, where I learned, I mean, the first time I heard about autism was in 1989, when I was the head of the department, linguistic department in the university, quite successful and happy with what I was doing. But you know what happened the year before, 1988, my son was born. And when he was 1 year old, a bit more, with month, he was diagnosed not with autism at the time. They didn't know what autism was. He was diagnosed. He was not two yet. Just listen, it for me it was shock. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Wow.
And severe mental retardation. You see, and the conclusion, there were three doctors sitting in front of me, was he was hopeless. Sorry, I didn't agree. And that's why, see, when I decided to research myself, what was wrong with my son, because I can't explain it. It was my feeling that he was clever. You know what I mean? His eyes were so wise for a one-year-old boy. I don't know. It was just a feeling. And as I worked in the linguistic university, and we had visitors from Great Britain, America, and so on, one of them happened to be a psychiatrist. And it was him, when he saw my son, he said, look, he has classic autism. This was the first time in 1989 I heard autism. And then they started sending me papers, books, and whatever. And I recognized my son on every page. You know what I mean? And interestingly, and now when I read parents, you know, their comments, when they say, oh, it's so terrible, or it's so beautiful. You know what I mean? So two trends here. For me, it was neutral. I was so happy I discovered what was wrong or what was different, whatever you put it. For me, it was not bad. It was not good. It was neutral. For me, it was okay, autism, what can I do about it? What is it? And that's how I started my research. So I changed the subject. And my next dissertation was, it was already in England. I moved to England because nobody there heard about autism at the time. And it was on sensory perception in autism. And again, even in England at the time, I was a laughing stock because nobody was interested in sensory perception at the time. Because, you know, the triad of impairments, right? Social communication and behaviors. I couldn't agree with that. You know, I knew that there was something different how we see everything around us. By his reactions, I could see that his perception was different. And that is why my dissertation was on sensory perception. And I was right. Now it is so popular, it's sort of, you know, so many books and articles about it. And my son, he did, yes, he was difficult. He didn't talk till he was 7. Screaming, yes, tantrums all the time, but not a word. And, you know, at the time I wasn't really, even now I'm not a religious person, but I remember praying, you know, every night, please start talking. I was so stupid at the time that I thought if he starts talking, everything would be all right. Of course not, but at the time I didn't know that. And I worked with him a lot. And yes, after 7, he started talking. And now he's 27. And he is autistic. Still not high functioning, but not low functioning either. And he's bilingual. So I'm very proud of my boy or young man, if you like. That's how I've come to this field. This was my interest. But when I finished sensory perception book, you know, I knew I couldn't stop because it's not good enough. Okay, we can understand how they perceive the world, but we have to go further. How they develop language, how they develop cognition, how they develop, you know, after that. Because yes, their perception is different, and that is why their language development is different. And if we don't see the connection, we won't be able to help them, you know. And then I started theory of mind, which I don't like. I'm sorry, this theory of mind, because you see, it means they say they lack theory of mind. Meaning that they don't understand our perceptions, they don't understand our emotions, they don't understand our intentions, they don't understand our behaviors. I agree with that, no problem. Mm-hmm. But I disagree that we say they lack theory of mind. I'm sorry, they develop a different theory of mind. Because right. do we understand their intentions? Do we understand their emotions? Do we understand their behaviors? Sorry, no. We don't. It means we lack theory of autistic mind, right?
Yeah.
So that's why it was the second book was Communication and Language in Autism. Third book was Theory of Mind. And of course, you know, the further I go, or the more I know about autism, the more I understand how little I know. And that is why I decided, no, I have to go further. And the next one was Autism and the Edges of the Known World. Quite controversial. It's about all this, you know, so extrasensory perception, which is not extrasensory. It is,
right.
It is sort of natural perception, but different. And after that, it was Autism and Spirituality. So, right. Yeah, this is the background for my books and for my work.
Great. Well, that was a very full summation. So it's obviously, needless to say, a very large subject. If we're going into spirituality, finally, I think it's good to start with specifics. I mean, I'm very interested in the overlap between what's been called autism and what's been called spirituality, and I think they're both misnomers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is kind of encapsulated in what you pointed out about extrasensory perception, that it's not extrasensory, it's a deeper kind of sensory perception that possibly we're all capable of, but certainly some of people being born now and throughout history are naturally capable of. And so I came up with an alternate model, as you may have come across, seeing as I know you've immersed yourself in what I've been doing, which is the extra-consensual perception model, which relates to language, not exclusively, but in terms of as soon as we start to adopt a model of social reality, then we learn to filter out any perceptions.
Yeah, absolutely. We construct our reality, you know what I mean? It's not reality that it exists, but we construct our reality. And in different cultures, it is a different reality. And different languages, again, they are also filters of this reality. If there are no concepts, no words for some things, we don't see them, you know. And another thing about definition of autism, you know, I would prefer the terminology offered by Mark Rams and colleagues. Have you heard about Henry Mark Rams?
Yes, I have. Yes. He works with Michelle Dawson, doesn't he?
No, it's Switzerland. They are from Switzerland. And, you know, they coined the term the intense world syndrome.
Autistic
people, you know, they perceive too much. They feel too much. Their brain works overdrive. You know what I mean? It's because in the past they were said mentally retarded, or now we say learning disabilities, but in fact they are overperforming because they have no filters. Because another research I really, really find very useful, sorry, it's by Manuel Casanova and his team, Mini Columns. Have you heard about them?
No.
Mini Columns in the brain. Well, they discovered, I think it is a revolutionary discovery, that autistic brains contain much more mini columns than non-autistic brains. A mini column is the smallest unit of the brain capable of processing information.
Right.
And you know that when autistic babies are born, in normal development or typical development, whatever word you use, there is pruning process. But in autism, so pruning doesn't happen, or, you know, not at the scale as in typical development. And they have more mini columns, and it means they are packed, you know, and the fibers separating these mini columns don't work properly. And it means this mini column, one mini column, cannot keep the signal. It goes all over the brain. It explains a lot in autism. You know what is happening? Manuel Casanova, he gives this example. He said, imagine you are having a shower and the curtains work properly. It means everything is fine. But if the shower curtains are broken, then water will be all over the bathroom. That is what is happening in autism. The signal is not kept in there. It's all over the brain, and it explains a lot, because see, many of them, they keep feeling sensation even if the object that triggered the sensation is not present anymore, whether it's a sound or whatever, they still keep feeling it, you know, so they are over connected. So I think it explains a lot, and I find it really, really useful. And if we go for this language development, you see, they have no filters, right? They perceive everything, all the stimuli around them. But it is impossible for any brain to process all this stimuli simultaneously, right?
Yeah.
But the problem in autism is they cannot filter. This is significant. This is insignificant. This is background. This is foreground. All the stimuli are equally important. You know, they are drowned in this stimuli. They are overwhelmed. They are easily overloaded. And that's how it started. They have no filters. And by the way, Huxley, I love his work, The Doors of Perception and, you know, Heaven and Hell. And he writes, he didn't know about autism, I think, at the time, but it was him who's, and Henry Bergson, the philosopher, they both wrote about lack of filters.
Reducing vowels.
Yes, in some people. And I think autistic people are very good illustration for this phenomenon. So they are lacking filters. It means they perceive much more than we do. And that is why so lack of filters at the sensory level. Then language. Again, as they perceive more stimuli, right? But our concepts are limited. You know, our perception is limited.
Yeah.
Right? That's why they perceive more than we give them names for.
Right. So, and language even is a filtering
technology
in a sense.
Language is another filter. And then we have cultural filters, right? And, yeah.
Well, this is fascinating. I actually got chills for a bit while you were talking. Because of my own experience later in life, I don't remember my childhood, but in my pre-adolescence, adolescence, and teenage years, I would have night terrors. If I got ill, particularly, generally it was when I got ill and I fever level illness, I would have these night terrors, and I would wake up and I would run from wherever I was, from the bedroom and from the house. And one time I even ran out onto the street and was going to get on my moped and just drive. And before I became aware of, you know, what I was doing and the irrationality of it. And one of the sort of corresponding experiences with these night terrors was sensory, and it's almost impossible to describe, but there were two elements that I can vaguely describe. One of them was the overwhelming experience of contrast between sensations, so between hard and soft. So, for example, my teeth and my gums, the contrast there between the hardness of my teeth and the softness of my gums. And this is almost metaphorical because it wasn't isolated, localized to my teeth or any part of my body. It was the whole of my experience, this unbearable contrast between what the hard and the soft. That was one experience. And another was much more overwhelming and much harder to describe, but it relates to, I think, what you're describing here about the how the information just spreads through the whole system. It was to do with every movement that I made, or micro movement, and it was internal movements too, so thoughts and everything. It seemed like it repeated over and over again, like forever. So I would make this very small move of my hand, and it was as if my hand had moved from one side of the room to the other and was doing it over and over again, like eternally, was the feeling. And it was completely overwhelming. I mean, the despair that corresponded with this feeling of being caught in this incomprehensible perceptual realm, was the prevalent thing, was just despair and horror. Like, I couldn't emotionally cope with the experience. Fortunately, it didn't last. It never lasted more than a few hours. But during those few hours, I was in some kind of perceptual hell.
And you know, some behaviors of autistic children, young autistic children, again, they become understandable. We can understand them if we know about this. You see, many autistic children doesn't like when their nails are cut, right? I know many parents who wait for the child to fall asleep and then crawl into the bedroom and whatever, because they can. And what is happening is, in the past, it was believed that because it was painful for them, because they are so hypersensitive, and it was painful. Yes, possibly it's true. Yes, for some it is very painful. But the main problem is this pain, this torture, doesn't stop the minute the mother puts the scissors away. They keep feeling it. And not for hours, for days. Can you imagine? If you are feeling it all the time, and then in 4 or 5 days, when they sort of feel nothing, 2 more days, and then it's time to cut their nails again. Can you imagine this? Or some even adults with high-functioning autism suffer from this change of seasons from summer to autumn and, you know, winter, because it takes them weeks to get used to expose their skin in summer. And when they get used to this, it's time to start wearing jumpers and trousers, you know. Again, it takes them weeks. So, see, if you know what is going on, you can help them better. You see, it just, it's so important to understand what is going on. This is my aim. I mean, I want to understand as much as I can. But, again, the more I know, the more I understand how little I know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think there's no substitute for direct experience as far as understanding, like you were saying, the theory of mind thing as well, neurotypical, whoever you know, came up with theory of mind, they're equally lacking a theory or an understanding of the mind that they're claiming lacks theory of mind. And so without direct experience of the interior perceptual realm of autists, it's I would say it's pretty much impossible. You can guess.
Yeah, that is why, see, I work with autistic adults now and Asperger's syndrome. I have many friends with autism and Asperger's syndrome. And again, we are learning all the time. And it is interesting. We are, again, researchers are very limited even when we research sensory perception, because usually it is seven senses, right? Or sometimes even five senses. It is vision, hearing, tactility, olfaction, gustation, proprioception, and vestibular. But some researchers distinguish between 32 or even more senses, and this is absolutely true. If you read, for example, Tito's books, he can see energy. Right. He can see, actually see energy, how it bounces off the walls and whatever in the room. You know, we don't know this. And of course, he is easily distracted because he is, you know, trying to trace all this energy around the room or other experiences we cannot even imagine. So you see, it's not good enough, vision, hearing, and whatever. Yeah, and about hearing as well, some are so hypersensitive. They can hear radio programs. Not just, you know, buzzing sounds, but radio programs.
In the airwaves, you mean?
If the transistor is switched off, but still is plugged in.
Right.
And, you know, my friend with Asperger's syndrome, she is like this. She, before going to bed, she has to unplug all the electrical appliances. Otherwise, she won't be able to fall asleep. She said the fridge is okay. It is so loud, she got used to it.
Right.
But microwave, you know, TV set and whatever, she has to unplug all these appliances. You see, and sometimes we cannot even imagine. That is why it is important to listen and, you know, learn about these new experiences. And if you've seen or read one of my books, you can see there are a lot of quotes because I do want people to know. Look, these people can experience this, this, and this. Sometimes it is hard to imagine, but these are real experiences for them. So it means their reality is different. And whose reality is more real? I'm sorry. Mm. You know what I mean?
Thank you.
But bring it back to myself again. I mean, we were talking about the changes in the seasons. Like, I'm very sensitive to that. When there's a real change in the weather, I feel it internally. Like, I might feel ill or physically. I have a physical struggle with extreme changes in the weather, and it relates, I think, to this: the body being a barometer that's constantly picking up what's going on in its environment. And I think it's very interesting to me. I was also, like, I wasn't actually diagnosed, because it took many years for me to even trust any kind of diagnosis. But eventually, I accepted that that I'd been suffering from what's called chronic fatigue syndrome, including the muscle pains, since I was about 20. But essentially, that has to do with the same thing. I mean, that was how I experienced it for many years, and that was why I was able to accept a diagnosis once I'd understood that the diagnosis was incomplete. But what people are calling chronic fatigue syndrome does relate to this, in that, from in my case at least, that the body is this very sensitive receiver transmitter, and it's sensitive not only to its inner environment, to its outer environment, but to the internal environment too, which is to say, not just what we eat and drink, but what we think and what we feel. And so I would notice that my body pains correlated very closely, although not close enough to map it, but enough to establish it, with the way that I lived, the way that I thought, the way that I was in the world. And I think that this is something that really is worth, I mean, it's very valuable about the autistic quote-unquote experience, is that we, as you know, biologically, the body is capable of so much more, and not just capable, but needs to be able to perceive so much more of its environment, and to be so much more at harmony with its environment. And if it's in a social environment that doesn't hold a space for that, doesn't allow for that, then a great majority of these perceptions that the body is having become afflictions, they become symptoms.
Yes, absolutely. By the way, it's quite typical, you know, experience of pain or allergies in people with autism. It is quite, quite typical, I think. I've met a lot of people like you, yes. And another thing, emotional development. You know, all these old textbooks on autism that they don't understand emotions and whatever. Yes, many of them don't. They don't read emotions, but conventional expressions of emotions, right? But in fact, they are very emotionally hypersensitive. Look at the emotion. What is it? It starts as a sensation, right? Because we feel it in our bodies. Whether we are angry or happy or whatever, it starts with this feeling, this sensation. And for example, if you feel sick, does it mean you have eaten something bad, or does it mean you are in love? Really? Because see, sometimes when you are so happy or whatever, you may feel sick. So that's why they cannot interpret emotions probably, but as they start with sensations, and many of them are very hypersensitive, they become emotionally hypersensitive. And another thing is, even if they don't understand expressions, we have to teach them how to express happiness or how to express this or that. In fact, subliminally, they pick up all the signals people emit all the time. They don't know that they send these signals, you know what I mean? It's non-conscious.
Yeah.
But these people, they are so emotionally hypersensitive. They pick up these signals. The problem is, often they cannot distinguish between their own sensations, right? Mm-hmm. And though they resonate with people. You see, if you, and again, it is understandable, there is research that emotions can be felt on the body. For example, a couple, and they are arguing or whatever, and the argument becomes louder, and some things are flying around the room and whatever. And then somebody knocked at the door, and they sort of stop. But this atmosphere, you can cut it with a knife, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can feel this atmosphere. So it is possible to feel it, but they are so hypersensitive, they feel our emotions. But again, they can't distinguish whether it is their emotions and what they sort of, what they mean. Can you imagine how frightening it is? Stephen Shaw, have you heard about him? He is also a professor at the university in America, and he has Asperger syndrome. He coined the term echo emotica.
Uh-huh.
And he gives this example that sometimes when I come in the kitchen in the morning, my wife is there cooking breakfast, and suddenly I start feeling something that is sort of, you know, anxious and unsettled, and I don't understand why. And then he asks his wife, you know, are you okay? She said, oh, no, this, and this. You see, he's experiencing her emotions, feelings. And right. Now he said it took him several years to learn how to sort of sort out this is mine and this is not mine. It's not mm-hmm. my problem. And can you imagine children with autism who cannot do this, who cannot sort out where emotions are theirs and where they are brought from outside? Can you imagine how frightening it is? So these people are so sensitive, not only sensory stimulation, but also emotional stimulation.
Yeah. Well, I think all children, to one extent or another, the kind of openness, psychic,
yes,
physical,
absolutely.
Emotional openness equals a vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that there's a correlation between what you're talking about, like if one is very sensitive to one's environment, including invisible factors like emotional currents and whatnot, and one is therefore picking them up, that is much worse if the environment that one is in is repressive. So if you're surrounded by people who are suppressing their own emotions,
yes.
They're not owning them, they're not talking about them, they're not communicating them consciously, so the person who is sensitive and open is actually picking up those disowned feelings,
yes,
and then taking them on unconsciously as their own. And this, I mean, there's this term, I don't know if you've heard it, Lloyd DeMaus came up with it for children, that they're turned into poison containers,
yes,
by
yes.
their parents.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, carers of autistic children, right, sometimes they trigger these challenging behaviors if they are emotionally unstable, and even if they pretend everything is fine, this kiss right. will pick up. And of course,
especially in
yes,
fact,
yes, you know what I mean. And that's how this challenging behavior starts, triggered yeah. by the carer or teachers or whatever.
Well, it's an interesting dynamic. this, I think, it's largely unrecognized in relationships, and it's an example maybe of how much there is to learn from this phenomenon called autism and understanding it, how much we'd learn about, I'd say, ourselves, because I consider myself on the spectrum, but how much human beings can just learn about the experience of being human and relating, because I'm married to an autistic woman. I mean, she's self-diagnosed, and it was through meeting her that I ended up recognizing my own characteristics as being essentially Aspergerian, and of course in any relationship, intimate long-term relationship, and I observed this as a child, but I didn't understand it, there's this dynamic where what one partner is not able or willing to talk about or even become conscious of, the other partner can end up picking up those feelings and acting them out. And so it's really hard to actually tell where one's own experience and feelings end and the other begin.
Yes.
And that can create all kinds of conflict if there isn't a willingness to actually recognize this mysterious phenomena. I was going to say transference, but that's a psychological term, but maybe it does relate. But it's really empathy. It's like empathy.
Absolutely,
is
yes.
It's not emotional empathy. It's like physical,
yes,
empathy.
Yeah. And by the way, that's what brought me to spirituality, because it's about connectedness, relatedness. You know what I mean? And yeah. Autistic people are very connected to everything. Because there were researchers who said, you know, autistic children, especially children, cannot be spiritual because they cannot relate to people, you know. But this is really wrong. Mm. The relatedness and connectedness is very strong in autism, but it is unrecognizable because it is different.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the idea of people itself is a socialized concept and even a social construct. Like, I am a person. We don't think of animals as people, really.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't. But they are discrete, conscious beings. So it seems as though the idea of a person and a personal connection is inseparable from this socialized construct of the ego self, which of course is anti-spiritual. I mean, it's even in the conventional spiritual disciplines, it's about transcending the ego to have a real connection. So would we even recognize a real spiritual connectedness if we saw it, if we're in that socialized identity self? Probably not.
Yes, and it is interesting, you know, that when I started reading philosophy, because you can learn about autism, not only from autism books, or possibly even these are the last books I will read, but from philosophers, say, like Henry Bergson. Again, he wrote about two ways, right, to learn about the world. It is instinct, right, and intelligence. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he says, like Darwin, he considered that it was sort of one goes into another, it is a continuum. But Bergson disagreed. He said it is two terminal points in evolution, and each of them is not higher than the other. And he then talked about intuition. And that's what I want to emphasize. I think autistic people, they've got this intuition. He called it sympathetic intelligence. Mm. It is fascinating. When I read his works, Bergson's works, when he described it, that these two ways of knowing, that intellect learns from outside and analyzes everything, that is sort of all these small parts, when whatever is built from, right? While intuition, it goes in the object or whatever and learns from inside. So it is really good to have this balance when the person is intelligent and intuitive, right? So in autism, intuition is much stronger. And Donna Williams, I love her work. I think she's a genius and understands autism so well. She writes about resonance, that some autistic people resonate with everything around them. And even some of them lose themselves in the stimuli around them, merge with the stimuli. So they become stimuli themselves.
Right.
Are you with me on this?
Yes, I am. It's funny because I was talking to Temple Grandin yesterday for this podcast, and I was talking to her about intuition, and I was having she was having a difficult time recognizing what I was talking about. And I was trying to talk about the same, I think, the similar phenomenon to what you're talking about. I was trying to describe the idea that autists had or were more aware of what all human beings have biologically, this internal guidance system, and that it's more than just instinct, that there's an instinctive, obviously there are instincts in the body that tell us what we need to know to survive, but there's also this other guidance system which is intuitive, which isn't about survival, not physical survival anyway. I don't think it's about survival at all.
And that's what I think, yeah. You know, intuition, instinct, Bergson calls instinct a sympathy, while intuition is intellectual sympathy. Right. I think it is a perfect description, you know,
Well, there's also a term, emotional intelligence.
Do you like it, really?
Well, I mean, I don't know what it the context it's used in, so I'm not referring to any of that, but just the idea of it, as I understand it, I think it's extremely rare to have emotional intelligence. To me, it's an intellect that is couched in or immersed in this nurturing emotional awareness, and therefore it's not divorced and separate. If that makes sense, yeah.
What I don't like about this emotional intelligence, because you see, the tests to sort of measure this emotional mm-hmm. intelligence are designed from conventional recognition of emotions. You know what I mean? Whether right. people can recognize, you know, facial expressions, body postures, and whatever. Of course, it will be very low. But they feel people, they sense people. I think it is very high. And these tests are not designed to measure this, because people who designed this test, they sort of didn't think about this type of emotional intelligence. The same when we use IQ. They are designed to measure whether the child is delayed, right, typical development, children, whatever. How can they measure this intuition and everything, the way these children learn? By the way, Temple Grandin, she writes about using subconscious to process information, right?
Yeah.
And these tests are not designed to measure this. See, because we use this conventional, again, cultural information to design this test. That's what I don't like about all this emotional tests and spiritual intelligence and whatever. No. No, for me, they're not good enough, you know.
Well, that's a good thing that you told me that, because I haven't been using the term emotional intelligence, but I was wanting to on occasions and thinking that it meant something very different. I didn't think of it as having anything to do with recognizing emotions or anything like that, but more to do with it's a quality. I mean, the way that I've used the term is a quality that I find very rare in people, that they're able to talk intelligently but at the same time be emotionally connected to the person that they're talking to.
Okay, what do you mean talk intelligently? Can I ask you?
Well, to use the intellect, like we're doing, to explore questions and to interpret and analyze and to try and figure things out, this is very enjoyable for autistic people. Actually, Temple Grandin said that's the only kind of way that she has emotional connections to people. And I'm the same. I'm not entirely the same, but generally that, to me, is my way of connecting emotionally to somebody, is to, not the only way. I mean, you could go for a walk in nature or something, but I mean in terms of really to have a conversation where the intellects are engaged, I find that's very satisfying, but only if the other person is able to engage with more than just the intellect.
You see, there are two things here. First, about empathy. Some autistic people have this high sensory empathy, like they pick up emotions, right? On the sensory level. Other people like Temple Grandin and, for example, Edgar Schneider, another American with Asperger syndrome, it is intellectual empathy, which is as strong as sensory empathy. You know what I mean? It's not one is stronger or whatever. And again, it brings so much satisfaction and whatever. And the second one about talking intelligently, right? Using intellect. Again, you see, I distinguish between this conventional intellect, if you like, right? And autistic one, for example, nonverbal autistic people. Some of them can write, okay, others can't. Or there are some autistic people who use only echolalia, you know, repetition of the same question and whatever, and they never develop verbal language. So you cannot talk intelligently with them, if I use your sort of terminology, right? Does it mean they are not intelligent? No, it doesn't. You know, we are talking about autistic languages here. That's why I said when I finished sensory perception, it is important to study it further. Because, see, their concept, it doesn't mean those nonverbal individuals, they do have language, internal language, but it is sensory based. It is not verbal. Right, but it doesn't mean they have no language at all and they are not clever, they are not intelligent, they are very intelligent quite often, and they have their own sensory-based language. And of course, depending on their sensory profile, it can be visual, like Temple Grandin, she is a visual thinker, right? And the majority of them possibly are, but some of them not. For example, Donna Williams, or my son, whose visual perception is very distorted, very hypersensitive, and that is why they develop auditory language. I don't mean all verbal language. I mean language of sounds, like, you know, what is going on around them, knocking and what. And there can be tactile language or kinesthetic language. You see, we speak when we want to speak intelligently, talk intelligently with them, we use our verbal language. And, of course, they don't respond the way we expect. For example, you ask a question, and my son would repeat it back, for example, right? Doesn't mean he has learning disability or in the past he would be diagnosed as mentally retarded. No, because our verbal language is a foreign language for these people. You know what I mean? Yeah. So can you imagine somebody will start talking to you but using a language you don't know? And then you wouldn't respond and they say, oh, well, I cannot have an intelligent conversation with him. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like the whole idea about trying to contact aliens or communicate with aliens at all. Even as a kid, I just thought that was crazy because it's the assumption that they would have the same basis for language.
Yes.
I mean, that it would even be recognizable to us as conscious intelligence communicating is so, you know, egocentric, so to speak. It's so narrow.
Absolutely. And, you know, when we say, oh, they have impairments in communication, I'm sorry. And as sometimes people say, oh, they don't want to communicate with us, or I cannot do anything, I cannot teach him or her to communicate. I'm sorry, they communicate, and they are communicating all the time. We just don't understand. You know, their body language and their gestures and their inner language. So who is communicatively impaired?
Oh, the siren calls into the wind. She sings her song again. And for the weary traveler, this just might be the end for a life that's full of sin. Oh, like a river, you are flowing. The bottom of the bottle called your home. It is cold, it is cold, it is cold. For in the end, you're always all alone. Condemned forever to roam.
You were following in their footsteps. It's getting slipperier with every step you take. Though you're ever so close to your own salvation, and they cry, witch, and burn you at the stake. Now your life's in the hands of the fate. We'll be right back.
ice that your skating's mostly thin. And the mirrors in the halls of your reflection show you a life that's soon about to end. And the darkness soon will begin.
You were blinded by your hindsight, and your dreams will all but be forgot. And the life you're living in the future will soon be gone, for it's about to stop. Now you're under the siren's lock.
Well, this does relate to what I was trying to describe before with emotional intelligence, and it's probably not a sufficient word for it. It's maybe like innate or bio or energetic intelligence. But when I can have a conversation with somebody where the words and the language are actually the least of it,
yeah,
and merely the surface that are allowing for an intellectual connection, but there's, even over Skype, there's this whole other hidden channel of communication or transmission reception that's going on between two bodies.
Yes.
And that's the real connection. So this is very interesting how you, I mean, it's helping me to see this more clearly, I mean, more intellectually anyway, that how language, we think of language as in very narrow terms, but really in a wider sense, language is simply a means to convey meaning. Ways to convey meaning. So.
No, but their language also conveys meaning. You know?
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. So even the wind in the trees and things that are occurring in nature,
yes,
that's a form of language because it's conveying meaning. The environment is always conveying some sort of meaning.
Yes.
That can be interpreted. So then language, as we think of it, in the socialized idea of language, something that can be written down, that can be decoded, that is fixed, is really the narrowest possible kind of bandwidth to communicate on.
See, because I see children especially who are echolalic, for example, who yeah, cannot sort of acquire the verbal language the way typical children can. I see them so clever. Can you imagine, it's a foreign language for you, right? Verbal language, for example.
Yeah.
And you have very, very few means to use it. Right? And still, they find way to tell us what they want. Echolalia, for example, there are so many functions of it. For example, it may be ask you something. When the child asks, do you want a biscuit? It yeah, means, I want a biscuit. You know,
right.
He cannot formulate the question because, you know, he has problem with verbal language, but he knows when last time his mother asked him, do you want a biscuit? He got mm-hmm, one. So next time he goes to the mother and says, do you want a biscuit? Meaning I want a, you know what I mean? They find ways to mm-hmm, communicate to us. We don't interpret it the right way. And I think their languages, autistic languages, are much more logical than ours. For example, as they cannot filter information, they take in all the details simultaneously, right? And that is why they find so hard to accept, say, cats of different breed or different color as a cat. They are so different. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah,
any
yeah,
tiny detail, and it will be a different word for them.
Right, that's interesting. Because that, when you were talking earlier about this faculty of the autistic brain, it was occurred to me that it's as though the autistic brain can't compartmentalize because everything bleeds into everything else, and how that seems to relate to a sort of compensatory activity where when autists do learn language and learn some sort of degree of socialization, they overcompartmentalize. They want to put everything into these very small categories. And I was like that as a teenager when I did start trying to develop a persona that would take me into society. It was about films, and I was just constantly making lists and filing cabinets, and everything had to be super categorized.
Yes,
and that was my
yes,
way of imitating what, you know, the social.
And that is why they don't like synonyms, why one and the same object can have two names. But on the other hand, why different right. sort of, you know, for example, right. if the child learns a ball, the word ball, and he is given a rubber ball, the child will learn that this is a ball, right, by smell, by touch, whatever visual image. But the next day you will give the same child a plastic ball. It cannot be a ball, I'm sorry. Right. It feels different. You know, if we know this, they do learn to generalize, but it takes longer, and we need patience when we are working on this. But in a way, I mean, I think they are better than us, because they can see any tiny detail and...
Well, yes, it's closer to reality, isn't it? Mm. Essentially, it's recognizing the differences between things, and maybe it goes hand in hand in some weird way with recognizing the... how everything is interconnected.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And by the way, to understand this connectedness, right, and relatedness of everything, I do remember I spent about 3 or 4 months reading quantum mechanics. Didn't understand much, but I did my best, you know. because I think it explains so much. It was when I was researching spirituality. Because, see, this, you know about it, right? The aspect experiment, when two electrons are emitted from the same source in the opposite directions, and if you measure one of them, the other, I mean, or sort of try to interrupt the way, the other will do the same, mm-hmm. and they are light years apart.
So the entanglement.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. You know, they are connected. Yeah. And that's why are we surprised that some people feel the connectedness to everything around them.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it does seem to make sense in an intuitive way that in order to be able to experience the interconnectedness of everything, we would also need to be able to experience how everything is different, because otherwise it would all just blur into nothingness.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I mean, I'm thinking of my experience of illness and body pains, and how, I mean, I began to understand again with my wife's help when I met her. I think she helped me because she suggested that I draw my body pains, draw a picture of my body, and draw, represent the pains and the discomfort through drawing. And which, of course, is a form of language too, image language, because, you know, I gave a name for this condition that I've had for most of my life, and it's mostly tapered off now, but occasionally it comes back. Like this morning, it came back, and I called it the Grinch, as in the Grinch Who Stole Christmas, mm-hmm. And I gave it a name precisely because I couldn't name it, I couldn't identify it, and I could never describe the symptoms. Like when I tried to describe them, I remember once to a girl that I was with in my 20s, I tried to describe them, and she said, "Oh, that sounds like it must be really nice." And I'm like, "No, it's awful. It's the most horrible feeling, but it's so subtle." And it's because we don't have the language. I mean, the language as we have it, that's been created, we don't have a language of sensation or of internal currents and all the rest of it. It's just, I feel sick, or I've got nausea, or I've got a pain, or I've got a headache, or I'm happy, I'm sad. And it really, I mean, the body is this vast region of signals, you know, and chemicals and currents and all the rest of it. And so really, it's like I would need a whole different language to even begin to describe what's going on in my body when I'm ill like this.
But you see, the majority do not experience this. It means they don't need any concept for this. That's why we don't have it in language. You know what I mean? Yeah. If everyone experienced the same as you do, so possibly we would develop concept for this. And if it is not in the language, of course, other people cannot understand it, what it is like. Using the concepts which are available, it's not good enough, right?
No, and I think there's an interesting sort of tension here, because I know it was trying to discuss it with Temple Grandin, this feeling I have that socialization, she's all for it and I'm all against it, but then of course I was socialized and I'm high functioning autist, so for me socialization is more of a burden than something that I want more of. And it relates to this, like, if I can't describe what's going on in my body in words, then I can't categorize it, I can't diagnose it, I can't sort of file it away and feel like I've figured it out. I have to actually go inward to the signal that's coming through my body, which is painful and unpleasant, but it's a signal that is communicating meaning. That's a language in itself, like the language of the interiority of the body. This is where I come into the spiritual concept, that the psyche is trying to communicate, is trying to live through my body, and it's not able to because of the poisons that have been put in my body. And a lot of that does relate to socialization and language. They sort of, that builds this character armor that then traps the poisons in there, you know, the things that we couldn't deal with consciously and process. I forgot where I was going with that. Just that I to go into that signal that's so unpleasant and listen to it, that's the real healing, and that allows me to connect more deeply to my body for that healing or that wholeness to come about between the psyche and the body.
Yes,
as I see it. Yeah.
But by the way, just to add about socialization. I do understand you, why you think it's not good, right? But on the other hand, I am with Temple Grandin on this. It is really important because people who are not socialized, right? Like my son, for example, they are very vulnerable. He needs someone to be with him 24/7.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Oh, it's sure. Okay while I'm still here and I can protect him and support him, but you never know. You know, people are different and some people can take advantage of him. You know, so this is my sort of worry. It is important to teach people rules and social traditions and whatever and how to behave in different social situations just to survive. I'm sorry. Yeah, I don't understand your point of view. I do.
Well, that's why I said there's this tension here, because you can't have one extreme or the other, as you are just completely helpless, at least in our current society.
Yes.
But it seems as though there's the line there, the delicate balance for me has to do with how much you internalize the behavior that you have learned to imitate to survive. Okay, fine, you learn the social mores so that you can actually navigate that realm, but if you internalize them to the point that you shut down your own interior sense of what's real, then is it worth it?
Yeah, yes, I agree with that, and that is why what I think is we have to teach them to socialize, right? But we have to learn their inner world, if you like, right? It's so unfair because we teach them theory of mind, we teach them this, we teach them that, but we don't learn. It's unfair, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a distortion of what's happening.
Yes.
If whatever's happening here, it seems to be a bridging between the inner and the outer, the autist and the neurotypical. So there's both worlds are essential, and it's the bridge between the two brings about the whatever the desired outcome, not bringing one world all the way into the other so that it's completely suffused in it.
Because it's so much we can learn from autism, you know, a lot. I'm fascinated with all this. Because it's really fascinating, something the majority of people never experienced and don't know. I think that's why we have to learn from them and teach them to help to survive and live, more or less happy lives. Somebody will be lucky, somebody won't, you never know. It's my worry about my personal, situation.
Yeah.
What will happen?
Thank you.
You have been listening to The Liminalist, the podcast in between. This was the first part of my conversation with Olga Bogdashina, the author of Autism and Spirituality, Autism and the Edges of the Known World, and other works available from Jessica Kingsley Publishers. The second part of this conversation will be online at autoculture.com/liminalist on Wednesday the 9th of September. If you'd like to support this podcast, please do so. That's it. Thanks for listening. Until next time, this is Jason Horsley, liminally signing off.
What you've suffered are nothing compared to what you see. If you let her, some overtake you, you'll be in chains for all eternity. You'll be stuck in this purgatory.
Now this is the end of our story. For the lives and souls that you have changed, they are laughing, they are laughing, they are laughing. For in the end, everyone's fate is the same. And the siren calls again. Oh, the siren calls into the wind. She sings her song again. And for the weary traveler, this just might be the end. Oh, this just might be.